old women. Lonely and miserable, right? Not.
Because there's nothing in the culture that suggests that we'll be extremely happy when we're 70 years old or 65 years old or 75 years old. In fact, the research in the book cites multiple studies that say the happiest people in Western civilization are old women.
That's psychologist and celebrated author Mary Pfeiffer. We talk with her about her new book, Women Rowing North, Navigating Life's Currents and Flourishing as We Age. Then we take a look back at some of the critical issues covered by the authors we interviewed in 2018. We play clips from 7 great conversations. That's all coming up on today's Writer's Voice. Thanks for joining us this hour on this station and at writersvoice.net. I'm your host, Francesca Rhiannon. Older women in our culture are at best objects of pity, at worst of scorn. So you'd think older women would be miserable. But Mary Pfeiffer says she was surprised to find out just how wrong that is. Despite the challenges of aging bodies, losses of dear ones, misogyny and ageism, and maybe even because of them, older women are deeply happy and filled with gratitude for the gifts of life. Their struggles have helped them grow into the authentic and wise people they've always wanted to be. In her new book, Women Rowing North, Pfeiffer examines the cultural and developmental issues women face as they age and explores how they can cultivate resilient responses to the challenges they face. Mary Pfeiffer is a clinical psychologist and the best-selling author of Reviving Ophelia, along with 9 other books. Well, Mary Pfeiffer, I'm so thrilled to have you come on to Writer's Voice.
Thank you very much. It's an honor to be on your show.
I have long been an admirer of yours. In fact, ever since you published Reviving Ophelia, which was your first, your probably most famous book about adolescent girls, now you're writing about women moving from middle age to old age. Can you reflect on your own evolution a bit through the stages of life from when you were the mother of a teenage girl to now?
Well, I'll tell you what, it makes me a believer in the concept of life stages because things are so different every stage of life. And when I was a teenager, I was in Beaver City, Nebraska, and it was a different era. It was, it was 1960 that I was 13 in Beaver City. And it was pre-television in that town. So, of course, the world was very, very different. And children were much more respectful. There was still an ethic that children were to be seen, not heard, and that life revolved around adults, not children. And so, of course, that has totally changed in our country, at least in many families. The stages for me, I would say, were teenage years, college years, and into the early 20s, which, as I mentioned in the book, I think, I actually, when I was living those years, thought, oh, these are supposed to be the best years of my life. I'm young and I'm pretty and I'm in college and I'm free and I'm unencumbered by family. But looking back on those years, I really feel like they weren't the best years of my life at all. But in fact, I was unmoored from one family, had not yet found another, and was very anxious about whether I would find meaningful work and a meaningful long-term relationship in my life. Plus, it was the 60s. I graduated from Berkeley in 69, and the culture was actually in the kind of turmoil it's in now, maybe even worse. So it was a very polarizing time, and I was bouncing between conservative Midwestern relatives and the Bay Area point of view, and it was really a dramatic and really, in retrospect, quite painful time. I had that gorgeous time as a graduate student and young mother and many years working as a psychologist. And then I had a 20-year period where I was a writer, So I really feel like I've had this rich, dense, and interesting life that has by no means been without tragedy and mental health issues on my part. I'm prone to depression and anxiety, and so those have continued to be struggles. But now I'm in a really interesting life stage, and I think it's good you started with reviving Ophelia, Francesca, because this reminds me of what I wrote in Reviving Ophelia, this life stage. I'm 71 now, and I'm writing about women primarily in their 60s and early 70s. And the cultural scripts about us are so different than the way we actually feel the experience of our own life and the ways we actually behave. So when I wrote Reviving, what really motivated me to write it was there was a cultural story about who teenage girls were, and there was a sort of sexualization of teenage girls in the culture. This was 1994. That was so incongruent with my experiences of teenage girls in therapy and my own daughter and her friend's experience, which was a lot of anxiety and harassment and much more interesting internal lives than anything in the culture would suggest. So it's kind of that way with older women, too. We have really discrepant scripts. For example, one of the main stories in the culture is that older women are bossy and difficult to get along with and not very attractive and not very sexually desirable and often in the way, and best if they keep silence and at a distance. But actually, women my age tend to be deeply engaged in loving relationships with lots of people, and we don't define ourselves by our attractiveness or our sexuality. We tend to define ourselves by our engagement, and we tend to be deeply happy people. You know, I think the life stage I'm in right now is catalytic. Because on one hand, we have a great deal of loss. A friend of mine died this week, and I'm going to do the funeral next week. We have a lot of loss. We lose some physical functioning. But on the other hand, we're really poised for gratitude and joy. And so this oscillation between sorrow and joy is really catalytic for growth. And I wanted to explore these issues because, as far as I can tell, Francesca, and you may weigh in on this, but I don't know if anybody's writing about women in a life stage.
Very, very few, in fact, and certainly nobody, I think, as well known as you are. And I'm really struck by what you say about a catalytic time. You know, I certainly am the happiest I've ever been in my life, and I'm a little bit younger than you, but not by much. I'm certainly within that age range that you're talking about in this book. You say right up front that there's one core concern of this stage of life. Tell us what it is.
Well, the core concern is with all of the perils and pleasures of this life stage, how do we cultivate resilient responses to the challenges we face? And one way to look at older women is we face the most difficult challenges of our life, but we also have the most decades of preparing to face difficult challenges. And so we don't come into this life stage without skills and hopefully without having many, many decades to develop our capacities for gratitude, and our abilities to be intentional about our attitudes. So we bring into this life stage decades of experience developing resources to help us cope. And that's very important. And one thing I say in the book is sometimes gratitude is presented as sort of a nice emotion or a virtue. You know, well, that person's very appreciative is a virtue. One of the things I realized writing this book is gratitude is a survival skill. That as you're preparing to give a friend's funeral, if you can notice the wild geese flying overhead, or if you can appreciate a good pot of tea, you still have the capacity to be a joyous person. And so it often is that the people who have suffered most have the most capacity for gratitude. And it's the people who have been suffered least that tend to have extremely high expectations of life that are never met. And so they're chronically dissatisfied. There's a kind of amazing calculus in old age that the more that is lost, the more deeply we appreciate and love what's left. And by the way, you said something that reminds me so much of what my women friends were always saying, which is, I can't believe I'm this happy. I never expected it. Because there's nothing in the culture that suggests that we'll be extremely happy when we're 70 years old or 65 years old or 75 years old. The research says that. In fact, the research in the book cites multiple studies that say the happiest people in Western civilization are old women. And I think it is because of our coping strategies, our generally good attitudes, our ability to call forth beauty and gratitude, and the fact that we tend to have a lot of rich relationships with women friends and with other people in our lives.
If you've just joined Writer's Voice, we're talking with Mary Pfeiffer about her new book, Women Rowing North, Navigating Life's Currents and Flourishing as We Age. And you know, what's so interesting also is that, you know, there are a lot of studies that say that married people are happier than single people, but so many older women are single, and yet, as you say, and I agree with you, that we are the happiest people in Western civilization. So I wonder if you could weigh in on how we cope or the resilience that we have around relationships when we may no longer be in that one relationship with a partner.
Well, one of the things I advise younger women, if they're, I really have worked very hard to keep friends of all ages. So I have a lot of women friends that are in their 20s and 30s and 40s. And one thing I always advise them is start now to develop a circle of women friends that know each other and meet on a regular basis and will be with each other as much as possible, given it's a mobile society, through the decades. And many women say that what really sustains them, whether or not they're married, is their relationships with women friends. And in fact, just this morning before this interview, I was at a coffee house with my women's writers group, and the friend we lost, wife, was there. And we were all helping her through this crisis. And that's what women friends do. They laugh with you. They listen to you. They understand you very well. And they help you through crises. So that's a very important thing. You know, the other things that come to mind right away with this is it seems like, at least for me and many of my friends, as we get older, we're more honest. We're less fearful to tell the truth. Not only to other people, but to ourselves. And we're more likely to be assertive about our own needs and wants. You know, I was raised in a generation where women were really taught, I was socialized, that women's duty was to serve. And my mother, one of her big sayings was, "Your wish is my command." And my Aunt Agnes was a farm wife, and we'd go out there for Sunday dinners. And she'd go kill the chicken and clean it and fry it and peel potatoes and mash them and have corn that she'd cut off the cob and make biscuits and pies. And we'd have this big, big meal. Well, she didn't even sit down. She circulated the table all through the big family meals, just filling up water glasses and replacing biscuits with another plate of biscuits and so on. And that was the model many women my age grew up with. So it's taken me, it's taken many of us, a long time to learn that we actually have more power than that and more agency in the world. So one of the things I figured out and I write about in the book is at some point I granted myself the privilege. I don't have to be in any room I don't want to be in. If somebody is being rude to me, or if I'm uncomfortable in a situation, I can just walk away. I don't have to sit and be in a situation where I'm deeply uncomfortable ever again. The other thing that happens, I think, with our age group is we start maybe forgiving ourselves and granting ourselves a little more mercy. At least most of the women I know are very hard on themselves and feel guilty at the drop of a hat, constantly second-guess themselves and judge themselves. But it seems like somewhere in the developmental stage I'm in, women start having the capacity to accept themselves and lighten up a little bit on themselves. And that's a really beautiful and important thing. And life gets so much better if that harsh criticism of ourselves and of other people starts to be a softer voice in our head, not a louder voice in our head.
You know, you mentioned before the myths about older women. I'd say probably one of the primary ones among them is the sense that we are no longer valued because we are no longer sexually attractive mm-hmm. to men or beautiful in that sense. You know, I have a friend who is a beautiful and accomplished woman, a writer, a wonderful poet, married to a loving husband. And she's really struggling with aging, with the loss of beauty, as she defines it. I wonder if you could talk about our notions of beauty and how they have to change as we become older.
Well, first of all, I think you're very lucky as a woman if you haven't built an identity around being beautiful or being sexually attractive or being appealing to men, because then it's easier. If you've had the burden of being extraordinarily beautiful, you're more likely to really struggle with the fact that you start having wrinkles and saggy arms or whatever it is. So I feel for your friend, because that's probably a pretty important part of her identity, and it's understandable it would be. She's probably been told since she was very young how beautiful she was. I was fortunate. I was not born a great beauty. I would describe myself as plain at best. And one of the things that meant is I didn't build an identity about being beautiful. I built it around being socially engaged and being loving with my family and being a good listener and having conversational skills and loving to read books. And those things last. So it's very important, I think, to help women define themselves in new ways, and also for women to just be thinking, okay, well, I get to add to my identity. Growing older is not a matter of becoming a diminished version of my former self. It's an invitation to recreate a self that is very sustainable for the rest of our lives. And when women think about their lives as an opportunity or a portal that they can enter and make something beautiful happen, they have more room to move. With old age, I really think a good line is, with old age, I think if we don't get better, we get bitter. And what I mean by that is, it's really important to stay green on top, to grow into a bigger self. And part of that involves gratitude and utilizing all our survival skills. Part of it involves understanding how much our lives are controlled by our own attentional processes. So, for example, in the book I say, attitude isn't everything, but it's almost everything. And I quote my friend Jane Jarvis, who was an old jazz musician in New York City when I visited her. She had a tiny little apartment. She could barely move from her bed to the piano with the help of a caregiver. And her apartment window looked out on a wall. And I was saying to Jane, how are you doing? Are you happy here? And she pointed to her head and said, I've got everything I need to be happy right between my ears. And that is one of our powers. We have everything we need to be happy right between our ears. And if we haven't lost our ability to think because of dementia, we can will ourselves into a good life. You know, when I was a little girl, I read, not a little girl, but junior high, middle school, I read Boris Pasternak's Dr. Zhivago. And that book had a tremendous effect on my life, because Zhivago was in a terrible time, the Russian Revolution, World War I. He was a rich man whose family home was all taken and many of his relatives were killed. But no matter where he was, he looked for beauty. And there's one beautiful scene in that book where he's on a train, he's with a lot of wounded men, they're going back to Moscow, this train is really hurting the wounded men, so they're kind of moaning, and it's cold, and nobody has any food, and this train sounds unbearable, the way Pasternak describes it. But what Zhivago notices is, as the train approaches every little town, he smells the linden blossoms. And so he starts waiting and anticipating and appreciating and remembering the smell of every linden tree. And that makes his trip bearable. And it's a beautiful thing to learn at 14 years old, that you can always look around for beauty. And there's never a moment you can't find it. So these kind of skills come in really handy later in life. I think we become more authentic. I think we become more reasonable in our expectations. For example, one thing that's happened with me is I have a big family. I have two children, and they have children and spouses and so on. And most of the time, we have our family holidays at my house. And I really work hard to make these holidays beautiful and buy brie cheese and good wine and really try to have everything just perfect for my family. And I used to have extremely high expectations for how wonderful these family events would go. Well, it turns out, a lot of times as the family left, I was feeling really sad or weeping or upset about something that had happened at those family gatherings. So now what I try to do before, like, our holiday coming up is just be able to say to myself, have reasonable expectations. You have an evangelical Christian conservative son. You have a very progressive vegetarian daughter. You have 11 complicated people in a room with a lot of needs at an emotionally fraught time of year. Just be kind to yourselves. Just expect that there'll be some disagreements. Expect that people in the room will have moments when they're not perfectly happy and loving with everyone else in the room. And the other part of that is this realization of the emotional well-being of everybody in any room is not my responsibility. And that's something I didn't know when I was 40. It's taken me quite a long time to learn that.
Especially being a psychologist.
Being a psychologist, being a big sister, taking care of people all my life. It's taken a while.
Yeah, I wanted to ask you about that because since I was, I'd say, a teenager, I adopted the motto, to be of use. And all my life, I mean, I've also been a social worker, been a clinical social worker, certainly engaged in my life. The most deepest satisfying thing to me is to be of use. And yet I also recognize that I have had to learn a hard-won balance to serve myself as well. So I wonder if you could talk about how we achieve a healthy balance between being of use to others and to ourselves, especially as we get older.
Well, we sound like kindred spirits, Francesca. And first of all, I don't think we achieve it. I think it's a process. I think almost everything that I do in my life at this point is about process. I don't expect I'll achieve anything, really. I mean, I just expect every day to try to be as engaged as I can in a hopeful and helpful process. But you and I were alike, probably, in that we were raised to be very good girls. And, you know, when I was a little girl, my library in Beaver City had books on Helen Keller and Dr. Tom Dooley and all these people who were helping the world. And my mother and my grandmother were very much people who said, your job is to help people. That's your job. And at the end of the day, my mother would ask us children, what did you do today? What was your good deed today? And that was just an expectation that, and I grew up believing the most important fact, in fact, the only thing in life that was really important, was to be a really good person. I still believe that. And that belief system has served me very well. I've had a meaningful life. I feel like I've been a useful person. I feel happy about almost everything I've ever done to be useful. But nobody taught me how to take care of myself. And nobody taught me how to include myself in my circle of caring. So when I'm making a decision, I hear all these voices in my head. My husband would want this. My son would want this. My daughter would want this. And the really difficult voice to hear is my own, saying, okay, you've got 10 people in your family circle of caring that want certain things, but what about that 11th person? What about you? What is it you want from an experience? What is it you need in this situation to be happy? So that is something that I've had to learn on my own. And of course, I'll never totally learn it. And I don't want to become someone who doesn't consider the needs of everyone in the room and doesn't try to do my best with other people. But it's also true that at my age, if you've lived in the same town and been a good person, there's a lot of people who have a lot of needs. And at some point, Francesca, you get to, and I get to say, you know, tonight I feel like staying home and reading a good book. Or no, I think I'll turn this down. It's just going to make my day too crazy, and I don't like being crazy anymore. So it's a process, and I can think that you and I are struggling with it. I think almost all the women I know are struggling with that at some level.
If you've just joined Writer's Voice, we're talking with Mary Pfeiffer about her new book, Women Rowing North, Navigating Life's Currents and Flourishing as We Age. I love that you say, you know, for example, that while older women fear being dependent and children want to be independent, that we're all interdependent all of the time.
Absolutely. Our culture looks at this whole business of multi-generations in so many wrong ways. Like, to me, in the perfect world, my children would live within a half a mile from me, the way farm families used to live. And we'd all be close and running back and forth. Well, I have a daughter in Canada and my son is 90 miles away. But we also have this expectation that if you raise your children well in America, they are mobile and they can be anywhere in the world, and that if they need to leave behind their parents, if they have children who grow up without grandparents nearby, that's the cost of a well-raised, healthy American adult. One of the effects of that is that in many cases, because people have left home, children, young people, are not with older people. And that has a lot of negative effects. For one thing, older people are often mistrustful of younger people because what they know about them, they know from reading, or they remember a bad experience they had with a young person. And the other thing is children and young people don't see the value of older people because they aren't around them enough to realize how interesting and complicated and fun they can be. So I wrote another book called Another Country after my mother died, about helping her generation die. And in that book, I talked a lot about the importance of what I called intergenerational bonding. And I used an example of, there's a little high school nearby that has a band that practices regularly. But one day a week, members of the community who used to be in the band show up and play with the high school students. Or I use the idea of a assisted living facility being connected to a daycare, so that there's a lot more connection between people of all ages. And at least in my experience with my own children, as I get older, I'm more dependent on them in this way. They take up a great deal of space in my heart. And I want to know what they're doing. I want to understand how their lives are going. I love it so much when they come to visit, when they call. In fact, it's funny, when I was a young mother and we'd go visit my husband's parents or my mother, they would be looking out the window when we came, and then they would come out to the car and wave as we drove away. My husband and I do that now too. We're so grateful when our children show up and spend time with us. On the other hand, we also are very important in nurturing to them. We're interdependent. We help those children when they need help. And we're there for them to provide some kind of family structure and solidity. And I truly believe that things go much better in this culture when there's a sense that every generation has its way of loving, has its gifts, and that the culture as a whole works so much better when we're not segregated by age. This is a culture that segregates by age in a way that historically almost no culture did. And I think it has a lot of negative consequences, Francesca.
I think you're so right on that. And, you know, I would end there because it's a beautiful place to end this interview. But I have one more question. I love the quote from Mae Sarton that you have at the end of the book. Old age is not an illness. It's a timeless ascent. As power diminishes, we grow toward more light. And I just wanted you to tell us, to comment on that wonderful quote and why you list it in the book.
Well, my own experience is this life stage is beautiful, and that it's a stage when we have the most capacity for bliss, when we have the most capacity to grow in moral imagination and empathize with all living beings. And it's also when we have the greatest opportunity for spiritual development. You know, growth often comes from pain, and there's plenty of pain in the later stages of life. And that pain can actually cause us to go deeper, to love people more. And at least in my experience, I'm having such a feeling of how beautiful the world is, how wonderful people are. And it doesn't mean I feel that way all the time. Of course, I'm a human with my bad days, and nobody should or could possibly expect themselves to, for example, feel grateful all the time or happy or blissed out all the time. It's not like this is like, oh, my everyday day. No, but it's this sense that I'm growing toward the light and that we all have within us the capacity to grow toward the light if we're just willing to walk through that portal and say that my opportunities for growth and self-definition are limitless at this moment in time.
Well, Mary Pfeiffer, it has been such a treat to talk with you. Thank you so much for talking with us about this wonderful book, Women Rowing North.
Thank you, Francesca. I really enjoyed this interview.
Mary Pfeiffer. Pfeiffer is a clinical psychologist and the best-selling author of Reviving Ophelia, along with 9 other books. Go to writersvoice.net for a link to a reader's guide to Women Rowing North. Next up, a look back at some of the issues we covered and the authors we talked to them about in 2018. Stay tuned after the break. Welcome back to Writer's Voice. I'm Francesca Rhiannon. The end of the year is the time for media folks like me to make our best of the year list. The dilemma is, there are always way more bests than can fit on a page or a broadcast. I came up this year with 17, and that clearly wasn't going to work. Instead, I've decided to focus on some of the issues some of those 17 covered and narrowed it down to 7 clips for your listening pleasure. You can hear the full interviews by going to writersvoice.net. We link to them on this week's show page. Starting off on the issues, climate change. Ashley Dawson's book, Extreme Cities, explores how climate change, urban development, and extreme inequality are inextricably linked. New York City is his prime example, but he also travels further afield to places like Louisiana, Indonesia, and the sprawling megacities of the African continent to show how the global drive for profits and endless growth are endangering our survival. But in this clip, I asked him about his personal experience of climate change-driven extreme weather, Hurricane Sandy in New York City, where he lives. You start out the book with your personal experience of going through Hurricane Sandy. I wonder if you could just give us a brief view of what happened to you and also what your psychological reaction to it was.
Yeah. So I live in Jackson Heights in Queens. And as the name of my neighborhood suggests, it's built on elevated land and it's in the middle of Queens. So we weren't threatened by the storm and we didn't have power go out or anything like that. But it was a bit of a harrowing experience because, as I write about in the book, the storm winds were so intense that they drove rain into the bricks and mortar of our building, and the water began to penetrate in through the mortar. And so I was woken up repeatedly during the night by this huge blister of water forming in the paint of the wall and then kind of draining down into the room. So that was very harrowing. It was felt like something out of Kafka, you know, with the wall kind of turning into some kind of animal and the huge blister forming and then the kind of weeping of the water into the apartment. But I really got through Sandy very much unscathed. And the next morning, delivery trucks were in the neighborhood. Everyone had power. So I really was very fortunate. But my experience was shaped by things that happened in the rest of the city. So I teach at College of Staten Island. And although the subway system was knocked out, I had to get to Staten Island to make sure I was chair of the English department at the time. I had to make sure that our courses were running, and we have hundreds of courses. So I had to make sure that students could get to campus, that professors were teaching their courses. And many people in Staten Island were very much impacted by Hurricane Sandy. You know, many people had lost their houses. Some people had lost loved ones. So I saw that impact pretty viscerally when I commuted to Staten Island. And then I had colleagues living downtown in Manhattan who lost power for many, many days. And they had gone through the experience of 9/11 and having a lot of vital services knocked out in 9/11. So they were somewhat prepared for it. But nonetheless, it was really unexpected to have the power go out and for people to be essentially unable to communicate for quite a few days. So what all of that, I think, dramatized to me was the way in which the city is not one unified space, right? I think that often when people talk about the impact of climate change, first of all, people often talk about it as a kind of global phenomenon, rather one that cuts across different spaces, particularly that impacts cities very, very strongly as a result of their highly developed and highly vulnerable infrastructure. And that's one of the kind of core arguments of my book. And that often gets rendered invisible in analysis of climate change and its impacts. But then in addition, people tend to talk about cities as homogeneous units. And of course they aren't. My experience of what happened to different neighborhoods in New York really brought that home. And the fact that it was very hard to move from one neighborhood to the next really brought that home. And so you asked about the kind of psychological impact. I mean, it made me realize how incredibly precarious life is in New York City. And again, I was very, very fortunate, but I was hearing about people living in places like the Rockaways, you know, or Red Hook, who lived in public housing complexes and, you know, NYCHA shut off boilers, elevators stopped working, and if people lived above the fifth floor, often they couldn't get access to water. So people were living in really, you know, life-threatening conditions in parts of New York. So yeah, real sense of the precariousness of urban life and the fact that New York, even though it's the richest city in the country, probably on the planet in some ways, is a very unequal place. So it's not only spatially different from neighborhood to neighborhood, but some people have access to the kinds of economic resources that make them more able to weather natural disasters of various kinds. And some people are living in a state of deep precariousness on a day-to-day basis all the time. And then when a natural disaster comes along, that precariousness is just magnified to a really dramatic extreme.
That was Ashley Dawson talking about his book, Extreme Cities. Our next issue, immigration. In her book, The Faraway Brothers, Lauren Markham tells the story of two young migrants who fled gang targeting at home to make a life in America. They nearly died in the desert on the U.S. side of the border, but they made it to California, joining their older brother who had migrated before them. Markham's remarkable tale brings home the promise and peril that immigration means for so many children in America today. We spoke with her before Trump's cruel policies ripping families apart at the border made headlines. Here's a clip from that interview.
So they had come north, unaccompanied minors, like so many other unaccompanied minors coming, not only from El Salvador, but many, many of them are coming from El Salvador. Why has there been such an uptick in unaccompanied minors coming from El Salvador, would you say, since 2014?
Actually, since it started spiking in kind of late 2011, early 2012, but we as a country kind of first really started taking notice in 2014, and there was an unprecedented spike in 2014. So yeah, the number is at current historical highs. It used to be that around 7,000 or 8,000 unaccompanied minors crossed into the United States and were apprehended every year. In 2012, that number nearly doubled. In 2013, it doubled again. And then in 2014, nearly 60,000 unaccompanied minors crossed into the United States. This past year, about 40,000 crossed into the United States. So it's lower than 2014, but higher than sort of it ever was before, right? And the reasons are complex, but it is a combination of sort of three main factors. One is the reason people have immigrated to the United States from all over the world for many, many years, and that is for opportunity, right? For economic stressors. Coming to the United States is seen as an opportunity to make money. The value of the dollar is higher than most other countries in the world. And so the value of what you're able to send back or what you're able to earn is higher. And that draws people and has for centuries, right? Of course, there's often a get-rich-quick myth that exists, certainly south of our border and all around the world. It tends to be a rude awakening often when people come and realize kind of the costs of the human costs of making that kind of money and the challenges therein. So economic draw is one reason that people are coming to the United States from these unaccompanied minors from Central America. Another one is family reunification because of war and just historic migration in Central America. Many, and certainly in El Salvador, the vast majority of Salvadorans have someone in their lives that's close to them who lives in the United States. And that could be a mom or a cousin or a brother. So those are sort of age-old reasons that people have come to the United States from this region. But increasingly, there's a new factor and a complex factor, and that is gang violence. And so gang violence is something we think of not so much as a pull factor to the United States, but a factor that's pushing people out of El Salvador and Guatemala and Honduras and into the United States. It's causing people to leave. And so if you look at gang violence in El Salvador, the uptick of gang violence and homicides corresponds pretty much exactly with the uptick of this kind of child exodus out of the country. El Salvador is one of the most dangerous countries in the world. It has one of the highest homicide rates of all of the world. And the perpetrators of much of this violence are gang members and now increasingly sort of extrajudicious police and governmental forces that are trying to combat the gang violence. So it's sort of this strange, unconventional war zone. And the vast majority of people who are recruited to join the gangs, as well as the vast majority of people who are killed and targeted by the gangs, are young people. So that is why so many young people, like the Flores twins, are leaving El Salvador and other countries in the Northern Triangle of Central America.
That was Lauren Markin talking about her book, The Faraway Brothers. Another issue we explored in 2018 was racism and white privilege. We spoke with George Yancey about his book, Backlash: What Happens When We Talk Honestly About Racism in America. It grew out of a 2015 New York Times op-ed, a letter entitled Dear White America, and the vitriolic backlash Yancey experienced from many white readers in response. I asked him why he wrote that letter.
I thought I needed to explore in greater detail the question of whiteness and what whiteness means in this country. And so I decided to write this letter called Dear White America. And I called it Dear White America because I wanted it to be very intimate. I wanted it to be honest. I wanted it to speak to the hearts of white people. So I wanted them to really consider this as a personal letter of love. In fact, I say that in the piece. so the article came out on Christmas Eve of all days. And then, of course, Christmas morning happened. And it was at that moment that I began to receive a great deal of hate mail. Now, what's ironic about this is that the letter was written out of a sense of love. And by love, I meant that sense in which James Baldwin talks about love, where he says, love removes the masks that we fear we cannot live without and know we cannot live with. Or the way in which cultural theorist Bell Hooks talks about love, where she said, love is telling the truth to ourselves and sharing it with others. So there was this way in which I was conceiving the letter as really an act of love, right? A way of making myself vulnerable to white readers of the letter. And one way in which I made myself vulnerable was to talk about my own sexism, the way in which I continue to perpetuate sexism despite my best intentions. So the way in which I not only have accumulated and the ways in which I've become inculcated by and with racist assumptions and racist images, in fact, pornographic images of women, but also the way in which I am part of a patriarchal system in which my advantage means their disadvantage, my privilege means their lack of privilege or their oppression. So I thought that that would create a potential bridge for white people. It would reflect for them a way in which they too could be vulnerable about their whiteness, about their white privilege. Well, it turns out that that bridge collapsed, that immediately after this piece was published on Christmas morning, I received hate mail, particularly in the form of voice messages sent to my university my university answering machine. Eventually, I got postcards that were sent to me, letters that were sent to me, white supremacist groups and websites, quote-unquote, discuss the piece. I would get hundreds and hundreds of email messages, the majority of which, in fact, the vast majority of which, were consisted of calling me the N-word. In fact, I've not been called the N-word in my life as many times as I've been called. So many times, it's very nauseating and has an incredible physiological impact on one's body. There were times when people would write to me, white people, and say, let's put a meat hook in Yancey, lovingly, let's put a meat hook in him. There were others who said I should commit suicide right away, right? So that's what it was. That was the backlash to writing this incredible letter I thought was a letter of love.
George Yancey talking about his New York Times op-ed, Dear White America, and the book it inspired him to write, Backlash. On to our next issue. Economic inequality continues to get more extreme. Some of the elite perched at the stratospheric heights of the economy have positioned themselves as saviors with a particular brand of plutocratic philanthrocapitalism. Anand Giridharadas's book, Winners Take All, that those who cause economic inequality can solve it by using the very methods that brought them their extreme wealth.
A lot of the forms of fake change that I write about change things without changing the distribution of power in our society. And what I am trying to push for is the kind of change that changes who has power. And one of the most important forms of power that needs to be rebuilt is the power of workers. And we need to restore the power of collective bargaining. That's why the workday is 8 hours and not 18. That's why children don't sweep floors in the stores of this country. That's why when you get sick or hurt on the job because of your job, there's some protection. That's why people get paid overtime. None of those things were the result of Mother Nature. They were all fought for through workers amassing a certain amount of power and leverage and using it to extract concessions. The powerful don't tend to concede. They tend to respond to power. So the evisceration of unions by the political right, but also, frankly, the failure of unions to maybe bring themselves up to date in the modern age, you know, make themselves salient to a new generation of workers that is more diverse, that isn't just white guys in factories, that encompasses people like your son who work in the gig economy. Unions need to also do a better job of finding a new relevance in the new age.
Anand Giridharadas talking about his book, Winners Take All. Well, it's not all gloom and doom. Like a body's immune system, people are confronting the challenges we face with democratic solutions. The growing cooperative movement is challenging the despotism of corporate capitalism. Cooperatives already comprise 10% of the global economy. In his book, Everything for Everybody, Nathan Schneider chronicles this revolution. Everything for Everyone, your book, the subtitle is The Radical Tradition That's Shaping the Next Economy. So you have two ideas there, radical tradition, something that's old, shaping the next economy, something that's new. And you open the book with a rural electrification cooperative that brought electricity to your grandparents. So that would be kind of traditional. Talk about the tradition of cooperatives in America.
Well, you know, over the last few years, I've been working with a new generation of people in this cooperative movement who are, you know, building businesses that are owned and governed by the people that they serve. And a lot of what they're doing is challenging. It's taking on new models. It's experimenting in some cases really radically. And I found a lot of inspiration in the legacy and things that have come before. Sometimes I feel like when I'm working with folks in this new generation, I would be irresponsible in advising them to explore cooperative models, except that so much has been built before. And I've started to learn to look around me and see cooperatives in places that I never knew they were, places like rural electrification, the hardware store down the street, being able to exist because of its purchasing cooperative. My family, who, you know, in some cases still farm in northern Colorado, are members of multiple cooperatives that enable them to maintain family farms. These are things that are not often talked about, but are a kind of economic revolution in our midst that is only partially complete. And with this book, I hope to kind of reinvigorate that imagination of what people a century ago called the cooperative commonwealth.
Nathan Schneider talking about his book, Everything for Everybody. One type of cooperative is the seed cooperative. I spoke with legendary agro-activist Vandana Shiva about her book, Creative Nonviolence. It shows how ordinary farmers in India are countering the efforts of Monsanto and other corporations to patent and control the global seed supply. That patenting has led to an epidemic of suicide among India's farmers. I asked Vandana Shiva why she started the Seed Freedom Movement.
I heard them talk about how they had to own the seed. GMOs would be the entry point for patenting. They'd collect royalties, which would be the source of their profits. They'd have to get bigger, and they'd be a cartel of five by the turn of the century. And they'd have to impose these patent laws to force every government to impose patents on seed worldwide. That's why they entered the GATT and pushed those treaties. I felt a chill. I said, if five corporations control our food and health, where is the freedom? So on the one hand, I said, we're going to save the seeds. I didn't know anything about the seed. I have to make a confession. I own nothing. So I went to my parents' libraries because they were very, very highly educated, and their libraries had amazing books, including on agriculture. Pulled out those books, and then I would go to the villages where I had worked with the Chipko movement, the beautiful movement of Hug the Tree, and I've just come back from visiting Sundarlal Bahuguna and Bimla Bahuguna, the amazing leaders, facilitators of that movement. They're 90, past 90 now, old, and that's why one has to keep honoring them. But the villages of Chipko is where I went. I take the photos. I said, you have the seed. I tell them to collect it, save it, multiply it. Initially, it was all seed banks with farmers alone. Then we realized it needed a more structural process, and we have now created 120 community seed banks. I started much later the seed bank of cotton after the suicide started, and our seed bank in cotton is now supplying organic cotton seed. Farmers growing organic cotton are earning 10 times more. They're not in debt. They're pesticide-free, toxic-free, debt-free, suicide-free. And my dedication is in the next 30 years to work for an India where we have the true freedom.
Vandana Shiva. Go to writersvoice.net to hear our entire interview with her. Finally, we end this year with a reminder of the gifts we receive from the creatures who share the planet with us. I truly believe that if humanity is to survive, we must honor the web of life that sustains us. We must get rid of the notion that we're entitled to dominion over animals. We must instead be in communion with them. No writer embodies this idea more than Cy Montgomery, author of the celebrated book, Soul of an Octopus. Her new memoir, How to Be a Good Creature, reflects on the lives of 13 animals she's known and the wise lessons they taught her. But even before this book, she'd written about a very special animal she'd shared her life with.
I wrote another memoir called The Good Good Pig, which was a memoir of my life with Christopher Hogwood, this wonderful pig who lived for 14 years teaching me and everyone in Hancock and beyond about comfort and joy until he died in his sleep of old age. And it's hard, though, to write a memoir, and particularly this memoir, because there's some wonderful things to share in it, but there's also some darkness in it. Everyone's life has darkness. But that was all the more reason that I wanted to write the book for readers who may have shared this kind of darkness, and to remind them that teachers are everywhere all around us, and sometimes they might have a flexible nose disc and a curly tail. You know, sometimes they might have eight legs or eight arms. That sometimes meeting an animal for just a matter of minutes can transform your life and help you see something important. And all of these animals showed me stuff about things that my readers would face too. You know, how to find your destiny and know what it is, and then how to set off on the path to that destiny, how to make a family, you know, which doesn't necessarily mean you have to marry an opposite sex person and then make a bunch of babies. There's many ways to have a family, and that's something Christopher Hogwood taught me. It's made out of love. It's not made out of blood. And how to face difficulty and danger and sorrow and loss, and how to fall in love with the world day after day after day. And that's what these animals have taught me.
Cy Montgomery. Her wonderful book is How to Be a Good Creature. Thanks for joining us on Writer's Voice all this year, exploring our world with the great authors who write about it. I look forward to you joining me for another year of great conversations. That's it this week for Writer's Voice. Go to writersvoice.net to listen to or download past shows, plus find out more about our guests or read book excerpts. You can also sign up to get the show delivered straight to your inbox, or subscribe to the podcast and the newsletter. And follow us on Twitter at Writer's Voice, all one word. The Writer's Voice webmaster is Bill Way. I'm your host, Francesca Rhiannon.